So I welcome you to our introductory course in mindfulness meditation. It's a 5-week course. And before I kind of start with telling you much more, people are still coming in. I thought it would be helpful for me to know something about you. And how many of you have meditated? How many of you are new to meditation? Never done any kind of meditation of any importance? And those of you who have meditated before, how many of you are new to this kind of meditation? And what kind of meditations have you done before? Watch your breath.
Create a visualization and
talk about. Okay. Anybody else want to say what they've done? Please, would you come in if you can? There are some more seats, I think, in here. If you want, there's a chair in the corner over there, over here, right behind the. There's another chair back in here if you want to sit. All the way in here on the other side of the stage. You can go through to the other side. So again, welcome to the introductory course. Mm-hmm. And I am Gil Fransdal, and I've been the teacher for this group for 13 years now, or 13 and a half years. Started in 1990 in Palo Alto. The group, as a meditation group, preceded me. Started in the mid-80s, and I was invited in 1990 to lead the group. And then slowly the group grew, and then a couple of years ago we moved here to Redwood City when we were able to buy this building. And I have been involved in Buddhist Buddhist meditation practices for pretty much my entire adult life. I was introduced to meditation the first time when I was 19, and that was 30 years ago. And been involved ever since. My first serious training in meditation was in the Zen tradition. I was introduced to Zen practice. And after some years of kind of being involved in it, you know, and I got involved. I actually moved to a Zen center, to a Zen temple, and eventually was ordained as a Zen priest and spent time in Zen monasteries, both here in this country and in Japan. And then at some point during that training, I went to Thailand and Southeast Asia, where I was introduced to the practice that we teach here at the center, which comes out of the Buddhism of Southeast Asian Buddhism of Thailand and Sri Lanka and Burma, for the most part. And it's a practice that's called in the Buddhist language, it's called vipassana. And vipassana is means something like clear seeing, to see clearly, to see deeply. The pasana means to see, just an ordinary word for see. And the V is kind of like an emphasis, emphatic kind of a prefix. So to really see. The practice of really seeing, or clear seeing. So it works fairly well to translate it into English as insight. So we call it insight meditation. So I was introduced to this practice there, and then was involved quite intensely for some time with a practice in Southeast Asia. Was ordained there as a Buddhist monk. And then came back to this country, continued both with my Zen training and with training in this Vipassana, this insight tradition. And eventually was trained to be a teacher in both traditions of Zen and Vipassana. And then in 1990, the reason I came to this area was I came to get do doctoral work at Stanford University. And can you hear okay, everyone? Just be okay. The speaker has a mind of its own.
A little louder.
It kind of goes up and down somehow. So it's a little bit unfortunate.
I had just raised it a little bit.
Oh, you raised it. Okay. So in 1990, I came here and to do graduate studies in Buddhist studies, of course. And so it's been what my adult life has been about. And here we are. And I've been teaching this intro class for many, many years now, first in Palo Alto, then here. And I love doing it. It's one of my favorite things to do, is to teach this class. For a number of reasons. One is that I get to teach something which I love. Well, I love doing, I love practicing it, and other people seem to get the benefit out of it. And also because it's something I know relatively well. I don't do with any notes, so I'm waiting to see if I can surprise myself. And I'm always trying to see, there's a new angle, trying to understand how to do the practice, and maybe I can learn something myself if I listen. So that's kind of a nice spirit for me. It adds to my interest as I'm here. The practice of insight meditation, vipassana, comes from the Buddhist tradition. And our center here is a Buddhist center. However, the way that this practice has come to America, the way it's been popularized in America, has been without much of its Buddhist garb. And it's in that spirit that I offer it here, that I'll be using some Buddhist references to Buddhism as I go along here. But if you don't like that, you can just forget that part of it. It's not essential. It's not necessary. The practice is not making you into a Buddhist. We're not trying to make you into a Buddhist. The idea is to just offer you a very powerful practice that hopefully will have benefits in your life and maybe, by extension, benefits for the lives of people around you. This practice has become quite popular in America outside of its Buddhist context. It appears, you can go down to the Kaiser right here in Redwood City and take a class in this practice. And you'll never know that it comes from Buddhism. They call it pain and stress management. Mindfulness-based pain and stress management. And there's been a lot of research on the benefits of meditation in general, but also the benefits of this particular kind of meditation on things like health and physical health, mental health, and so forth. So some people practice it just for those reasons, what we might call secular reasons. And some people will practice this practice as a Buddhist practice, as a spiritual practice. Many people who are involved in other religious practices find that the mindfulness practice seems to augment and strengthen or develop their capacity to do other religious practices. Very simply because you're developing skills to learn how to be more fully present and involved in what you're doing while you do it. So any other practices you're doing, people tend to be able to throw themselves into it more fully because some of the things that get in the way tend to be taken care of. In the Buddhist tradition, this very simple practice that they teach right at Kaiser is understood to be the practice which leads to what's called enlightenment or awakening or liberation. And so the ultimate goal of Buddhism, the Buddhist teaching, is something called enlightenment. And it's a human possibility for all of us. And this is the practice that leads there. So there's a whole range of ways in which people then involve themselves in this practice. Some will do it mostly for stress management. Some people will do it to support their spiritual life. And some people will do it in a quite dedicated way for the purposes of liberation. How it is for you, I don't know. What you'll make of it. Probably most of you who are here are beginners, and probably you're not so ambitious in terms of full enlightenment. Hopefully not for tonight. The basic tool for this meditation practice is your own capacity to pay attention, your own awareness. And the practice is taking a muscle that you already have, or a faculty you already have, that of paying attention, and then developing it, strengthening it, strengthening that muscle. So it becomes a kind of a support for much of your life, and so that you can actually, with it, with a strong attention, like kind of like a magnifying glass, you can actually see much more deeply into your life than normally people do when they just kind of go about their normal life. What most people find is as they try to develop their attention into the present moment, to what's happening in the present, one of the first things they become aware of is how difficult that is. It's seemingly a very simple thing to do. Just, you know, sit down and pay attention to what's happening. My mother used to tell me that all the time. And it seemed like an obvious thing to learn how to do. But as you try to do it, you find the mind has a strong momentum, strong tendency to be anywhere else but the present moment. The mind wanders off into the future, planning. The mind drifts off into the past. The mind drifts into fantasy. The mind drifts into a lot of judgment and evaluation, which is not really connected to the present moment. And it's so easy, what we find, it's really easy to slip away from the present moment. And sometimes it becomes quite elusive and frustrating because it's so hard to stay right there in a very clear, consistent, dedicated way. And so this practice then becomes a training for developing our capacity to be in the present moment, to be here and now. Let's see, do we need more chairs in here, or are you going to be okay on the floor? There's one chair in the back, and it looks like another chair there being made free. And so the basic tool of the practice is something we already have. So it's not something Eastern or mystical. Just using our ability to pay attention and then developing that ability. So it becomes something that's not just a potential tool, but becomes a powerful tool that we can use in our lives. And in the process of discovering how to use that tool or developing that tool, you'll also learn certain skills. And one of the skills you'll learn is how not to be caught by your stress, how to kind of de-stress yourself and then to relax and to become calm. And more important than that, more important than learning how to become calm, is you'll start learning how to pay attention to those tendencies inside of you, those forces inside of you that build up to create stress for you. And because many times we attribute stress to the external world, but more often than not, it has a lot to do with how we relate to the world. So if I'm driving down the freeway and someone cuts me off, and that's stressful, it might be a stressful event in and of itself, but the added stress, most of the stress might come with my fury, my anger, and indignation, and about, you know, how could this person be getting my way? I'm in a hurry to get somewhere, and I tighten up and drive in a more stressful way. And so that has to do with my kind of way of picking that up. I got involved, I was ambitious, I was aversive. And so part of what this skill that you want to learn in this practice is you start learning how it is that your mind works. How is your mind grasps things, pushes things away in a way that is not helpful for you, in a way that causes added stress or suffering in your life. So we develop our capacity to see clearly. As we do that, we learn to develop a calmer life, to be calmer and more relaxed. And we start learning to see how it is that we create stress, how it is we create unnecessary suffering in our lives. And part of the fascinating process that goes on is as the mind gets quieter and calmer and be able to see more clearly, what we discover is that there are layers and layers of ways in which we live, the mind works, the heart works, that are we don't normally see because we're so caught up in the surface chatter of the mind or the preoccupations of taking care of our life in many ways, that we don't see some of the deeper currents of what goes on in our psyche. And those deeper currents sometimes are, on one hand, can be some of the most treasured and precious aspects of who we are. Deep currents of love, or equanimity, or compassion, of peace. But also some of those deeper currents are things we would rather not look at. Sometimes if we stop and be really attentive to what's going on in our life, we find out that maybe fear is a predominant undercurrent that seems to be kind of lurking in the background all the time. And so we start seeing that through this practice. So we see both what was really beautiful about ourselves, and we can also start seeing what's difficult about ourselves. We see this maybe fear, or we feel a constant kind of aversion or anger about things we see, or a constant preoccupation about the future and always planning. Or we start seeing how things that normally we can't see if we stay always busy. All that is considered very useful. It's helpful to develop a mature life, to see how all this stuff works, and to begin to plumb down into the depths of our psyche, our hearts, or our minds, and to see what's going on. And for that, we need to develop some level of calm. So the mindfulness practice is a practice of developing our attention. And to say it maybe even simpler is that it's developing our capacity to simply see what is happening in the present moment. To notice, oh, this is happening now. That sounds, you know, easy enough. Aside the difficulty of being in the present, you'll notice another difficulty that arises is that we are often experts. We have a very strong habit at judging what's happening in our experience. So we don't just simply hear the sound of a wonderful bell. This is probably not a good example, but you hear the sound of the bell, and then that's just hearing the sound of the bell. You notice it. But your mind will start judging that. Oh, I wish a gill had hit it harder or softer. Or, that was a great sound. I wonder if I can buy that bell. Or, why do they have bells? You know, these Buddhists, they're all about bells. And, you know, they should just have horns or something. And so the mind kind of makes commentary, stories, and judgments about what we're experiencing. And all those stories and commentaries and judgment is part of what can add to the stress of our lives. So as we're developing this capacity to notice, to pay attention to what's happening at present, we're also learning how to let go of that tendency to immediately, in the heels of noticing something, judging it, criticizing it, wanting it, holding on to it, you know, pushing it away or holding on to it, grabbing it, doing something with it. Doing something with it besides just letting it be there in awareness. So it's phenomenally simple, the practice I'm going to teach you, in principle. But to actually do it is not always so easy because of the tendencies of the mind that can be quite different. Some people say it's very easy, that to be mindful is very easy. What's difficult is to continue doing it, or to remember to do it. Can you still hear? Can you guys hear okay? If you have trouble hearing, you should let me know. What? Raise your hand. So in teaching you this mindfulness practice, I'll do it systematically. And rather than paying attention to everything that's happening in the present moment from the get-go, the way we usually do this practice, how we usually teach it, is we start developing our attention on something very simple and something basic, something we all have in common, and that is our breathing. So today I'll talk about using the breath as a kind of place to sharpen and develop both our mindfulness and our ability to get calm. And then the second week of this series, we talk about how to bring wise attention to our body, to our physical experience. And it turns out that Buddhist spirituality is very strongly based on being embodied, being in our body, something that many people are not very much. And so learning how to be in our body is a tremendous support for paying attention. And if you thought attentiveness with something just cerebral, you'll come next week and learn that a lot of it is to do with being in your body. And then the third week, we'll talk about mindfulness of emotions, how to use emotions as a place to wake up and pay attention, how to pay attention to emotions so we're not caught by them or burdened by them, but so we kind of be free in the midst of having an emotional life. And then the fourth week we'll talk about thoughts and how to bring mindfulness and attentiveness to the world of our thinking. And then the fifth week, the last week, we'll talk about how you might want to continue developing the practice and how about integrating this mindfulness practice into your wider life outside of meditation itself. So that's kind of the sequence. And what happens is that the instructions kind of build on themselves. So as you learn to pay attention to your breath, it'll be a lot easier for you to learn the instructions for pay attention to the body. As you learn how to pay attention to your body, it's a lot easier to pay attention to your emotions. And as you learn to pay attention to your emotions, it's a lot easier to pay attention to your thoughts. So it kind of builds. That's why we do it in that way. If we started with thoughts, it's not going to be very helpful for you. So we build on this foundation as we go along. Another way of thinking about awareness, the mindfulness practice, is that it's about making room in your mind. And the analogy for this is, imagine yourself in an elevator, a small elevator meant for two people, and there's you and four other people. And these are people who are, you know, twice as tall as you, and really big, and they haven't showered for a number of days, and they're slobs, and they have this ketchup dripping down their shirt, and you have your nice satin shirt on, you know, and whatever, and you have to kind of be squeezed into the elevator, and probably, you know, it's a relatively uncomfortable situation, and you probably feel claustrophobic and burdened or you're oppressed by this kind of situation. Then, imagine the same five people, you and those four people, are in some huge, vast, spacious cathedral. And you're the only people in there. And you're spread out evenly throughout the big room. And you can see them down there on the far side. And then it's easy to love all of humanity. You know, you have all this room. You know, it's easy to kind of, you don't feel burdened or pressed in by all these, you know, these people in that kind of situation. Well, our mind is often the same way. Our mind is often claustrophobic and pressed in on by its preoccupations and concerns, its thoughts that ride one after the other, or our fears, or our many kind of preoccupations, obsessions that the mind has. And sometimes our suffering arises because we're so caught up in the middle of this tightness of our minds. And part of what mindfulness can do is it creates room in the mind. So nothing has to be any different. You don't have to get rid of anything when you practice mindfulness. You don't have to stop having anger or stop having happiness or stop having tension in your body or stop having, you know, anything at all. But rather what we're doing is creating lots of room in the mind so the room experiences it in a very, the mind experiences it in a very spacious way. And on all that spaciousness of mind, it's very easy to take in the experiences of life, take in the experience, internal experiences and external experiences of what's going on. So as the mindfulness develops, you probably start noticing this sense of having more room, or having more space, not being so tightly glued or with your experience. The last thing as an introduction that I'll say is that this practice is meant to be a practice or a training. And you, just as you can't sit down and know how to play the piano just first time you sit down to play the piano, you have to train and do scales and kind of learn how to do it. And slowly over the days and months and years, you develop an aptitude for playing the music. So in the same way it is with this practice here. It's a skill, it's an art that is learned. And you learn it by doing the training, by doing it over and over again and practicing it. And after a while, it becomes second nature. So the meditation practice begins with the breath. But before the breath, it is useful to be in your bodies, to be in your posture, to have a good meditation posture. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the posture that you might sit in. And then we'll do a little bit of meditation practice. So one of the most important principles for posture in meditation is that you want to be able to sit with a straight back. For most people, especially people who sit at desks much of the time, it means to sit with a straighter spine than you normally would have. To have a sense of kind of vitality, or kind of wake up the spine as you're sitting. And for that purpose, I'll talk a little bit about meditation posture for the floor, for sitting cross-legged on the floor, and also about how to do it in the chair, which you're welcome to do. If you're inclined to want to try sitting on the floor, there are some cushions up there you're welcome to borrow, a few of them up there. And you can get them now or in a few minutes or whatever. And so I'll first say a little bit about the floor. Part of the reason why cross-legged is the kind of strongly associated with meditation practice is that sitting cross-legged creates a nice tripod, three points, the knees and the butt, that create a nice firm base that makes it relatively easy for the torso then to feel well-balanced and supported by that solid base. You don't get quite the same kind of support in a chair because you don't have this wide support. Also, sitting on the floor cross-legged brings your center of gravity down lower to the ground. And so it's easier to relax in a deeper way sometimes when you have a low center of gravity. You're kind of, you know, easier to be grounded and firm. But it's fine to sit in the chair if you'd like. So on the floor, I recommend that you sit actually not cross-legged, but have one leg in front of the other. Sometimes it's called Taylor fashion or Burmese fashion, like this. And the reason for that is that that way the legs are not, the body is not being torqued or twisted or like if you sit half lotus, like this, you stretch out one part of your body more than the other. And also you tend to list a little bit if you just kind of relax. And so you have to kind of make effort and stretch out to kind of be straight up and down. But if you sit Burmese fashion, you're pretty symmetrical. And so it's pretty balanced this way. Also, for most people, it's a lot easier because you don't torque in your knees or your ankles so much. And in sitting this way, it's recommended you sit on some kind of cushion. And these round cushions were designed for sitting on, for meditation on. And this, you sit on it. Usually the idea is to sit in the front half of it or the front third of it. Kind of, if you can imagine, it's kind of a slope going down in the front. You sit in the front slope. And you want to sit up on a cushion so that it becomes easier to get your knees down on the ground. And the idea is you want your knees touching the ground. And if the cushion you have is, if you're not getting your knees down on the ground, then probably you would if you had more height. So if you can get some kind of support, another pillow or something to put underneath your pillow, then you can get more support and you probably get your knees down. I think everybody can get their knees down if they get high enough. But if you get too high, like if you pile two or three cushions on top, either you slide off or the pillows pop out from behind. So that doesn't work so well. If you don't get your knees down, what you can do is take something else like a pillow or a towel and put it underneath like this so that the knees are supported. They're not hanging in the air, kind of stretching. And that can make it quite nice. And the reason, one of the reasons to sit on the cushion, as I said, is to get the knees down, but also to create a little bit of a pelvic tilt, pelvis tilt forward a little bit, so that your lower spine, your lower back, is at least has its normal curve in there, the kind of healthy, normal low back curve, or if anything, ever so slightly accentuated. Some people are overarched in the back, lower back, but ever so slightly kind of accentuated, there's some strength there in the lower back to hold the rest of your torso upright. There are other ways of sitting on the floor. Another way is to... I've been sitting lately on one of these rather than a round cushion. It's called a half moon. And I kind of like it because it spreads the weight more evenly through around my butt and my thigh. So some people like their weight spread more, and this works well. And another way of sitting is to take a round cushion like this and put it upright and then... put it between your ankles, between your feet, and then sit on it like this. And for people who can't sit cross-legged, or this is a nice alternative, this way here. And a variation of that is to use a bench like this. Like that. And I don't know if we have any benches here, but you're welcome to try these if you want to try a bench. And these things can be acquired at various places. They get them online from places. You can get them. I think East West Books sell these things. And also Allison, who's sitting there, She has a little business of selling these things, and she sells them cheaply. And if you want to get some, you can talk to her about what she does. And then sitting cross-legged, well, let's leave it at that for now. Sitting in a chair, you don't want to cross your legs. And the classic chair posture is to have both legs parallel to each other, going out with the feet firmly planted on the ground with a right angle, more or less a right angle with your knees. It's said that when you sit in a chair, you don't want to have your knees higher than your hips. So if that's the case, then you want to get some kind of cushion or pillow to sit higher so that your knees are the same height as your hips, probably better, slightly lower. Your knees are slightly lower than your hips. And partly that's because that supports the back better that way. If you're sitting on a chair, the recommendation is that you do not use the backrest. Some people have to use it because they have back injury or something, and you're welcome to use the backrest then. But the advantage of not using it is that there's a wonderful reciprocal or mutual relationship between our inner life, our psyche, and our body. And if we want to develop a kind of inner self-reliance, an inner self-reliance, it turns out it's a little bit easier to find that psychological self-reliance if your body is being self-reliant also. But if you're leaning against something, then it's a little bit harder. You can see that a little bit because sometimes in the attitude that's sometimes expressed in the way some people sit sometimes, or how you sit sometimes, that sometimes you can almost see you've kind of resigned yourself, you know. And there's an attitude sometimes expressed in the way we sit. And so by taking an attitude of sitting, or at least sitting upright, you're at least correcting for some of the inner attitudes that might be a hindrance to being clearly attentive and aware in the present moment. If you're sitting on the floor, or sometimes in the chair you can do this, you take your hands on either side of your hips, on the side of the chair or on the floor, and lift yourself almost off the cushion or the chair. And so your chest comes forward, kind of gets pushed forward. And then as you release your hands, you let your shoulders roll back. And then you'll probably find yourself sitting much straighter than you were before. And you might even find your shoulders kind of hanging in a nice way, and your chest a little bit more open, which is nice for meditation. We want to have a straight spine, and we want to be a little bit attentive. You're not leaning forward, slumping forward, or leaning to the side, but sitting upright. So the center of gravity kind of goes, almost like goes through your spine. That if you're leaning forward too much, you can feel your center of gravity in front of you. And you want to keep it right down the middle. You can do anything you want with your hands, but both hands are doing the same thing. I tend to have my hands on kind of just on my thighs here. Some people have them, I usually have mine facing down. Some people have it facing up. The classic Buddhist posture for the hands is to have the hands together in front of your, just below your belly button, with thumb tips touching, and just one hand cradled in the palm of the other. And you've probably seen some Buddha, so he's doing it here. And so there are various ways of doing it. What you want to do is make sure that your hand is not so far forward or so far down that it puts a strain on the shoulders or the back of the neck. And sometimes, if you have your hands like this together but resting on your ankle, that can sometimes be pulling you forward. If you have it too far forward on your knee, you can be pulled forward. So you either pull it back, or if you have it in front of you here, is you can put a cushion like this so your hands are held up higher. And that can prevent kind of collapsing or the strain that can happen sometimes on your upper back. So then the head should be aligned on the shoulders, which seems, you know, absurd to have to say. But you'll sometimes see people who are heads are leaning a little bit this way or turn this way when they're meditating, or leaning forward like this, or poking up like that. And so it's you want to keep it kind of well balanced. It's said so your ears are aligned with your shoulders. It's often said that with a head, it's actually useful to tuck your chin down and back a little bit. Or another way of doing that is to make a little bit of space between the last vertebrae in your skull. Open that up a little bit. And it's said in the ancient venerable texts that if you tuck your chin back and down a little bit when you meditate, you'll think less in meditation. You'll control the thinking mind. You won't believe it, but that's what the texts say. So you can maybe, you know. And in our tradition, we tend to sit with the eyes closed in meditation. It's not required. There's many people who sit with their eyes open. But we, you know, unless there's other reasons for it, we encourage you to sit, meditate with your eyes closed, and gently close your eyelids. And then the tongue is, the mouth is kept closed, lips are closed, and the tongue rests up against the roof of the mouth. That also said to control the wandering mind. So that's the basic points about posture. Do you have any questions about that? Seems clear enough? So, I think we're going to then try this meditation out. But some of you have been sitting now for a while. Please, if you'd like to stand and just stretch your legs a little bit for a minute or 30 seconds, it might be helpful before we do the meditation. Turn it down, the heater.
A little cooler.
Yeah, turn it. You know how to do it?
Yeah.
Yeah, just because I think it's warm. If anybody wants to try this bench or one of these cushions here, please come up here and borrow them. If you need to use a backrest, then the way she's sitting is really good. But you have, ideally, you would use a backrest in your lower part of your back, and maybe take a towel and roll it up and stick it there in your lower part of the back, and really get in there really snug with your, with the chair. But so your upper part of your back is not using the backrest. So, so take a few moments now to be attentive and careful about your posture. Take a posture that expresses alertness. Your body is alert. And then close your eyes. And to begin a session of meditation, it's often helpful to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Relaxed breaths. And as you fill your torso and expands, let it kind of be like a massage that stretches your rib cage, your belly. And then as you exhale, a slow, long exhalation, let your shoulders, your rib cage, your stomach, your body relax. As you breathe in deeply, let your stomach be relaxed. Breathing in deeply, full breath, stretching the torso. And then as you exhale, let go. Let go of any tension that you can. And then allow your breathing to return to normal. There are certainly meditation practices that involve breathing in particular ways, yogic breathing. In this particular meditation practice, no effort is made at all to breathe in some unusual way. Whatever way you happen to be breathing is fine. And then as you're sitting here, see if there's any places in your body where there might be some tension, some holding. And then as you exhale, see if you can a little bit soften that or let go of it. You might do it systematically, starting first with the forehead and the eyes, feeling the eyes, the forehead, and then relaxing. The face and the jaws. You might feel your shoulders, a place where many people have some tension. Just feel it for a moment. And then if it's easy enough as you exhale, have a little softening of your shoulders or around your shoulders. Particularly useful to soften the belly. If you can, kind of let the belly hang forward. If it tightens up right away, then don't worry about it. But if it's easy enough to let the belly hang, so having taken some deep breaths, having relaxed a little bit with your body, see if you can find a sense of presence within your body. The presence of your body, being present in your body, feeling the vitality of your body, the livedness of your body. And then as part of your body, become aware of how your body experiences the process of breathing. Become aware of what happens in your body as you breathe. Perhaps your belly moves up and down or out and in. Perhaps your chest moves in and out or expands, contracts. Perhaps you feel the air passing in and out through the nostrils or along the back of the throat. Notice what part of your body most clearly expresses the process of breathing. If you have trouble finding your breath, noticing how the body experiences the breathing, you can put your hand on your stomach and feel the movement there. Or you can breathe a teeny bit bigger than normal just to feel a little more intensely what's going on as you breathe. And so, right, the practice is very simple here. And that is to keep your attention centered on the experience of breathing. There's a rhythm to breathing in and breathing out. Hang in there for that rhythm. Breathing in and breathing out is always happening in the present moment. So that if you're with your breath, you're in the present moment. Inevitably, the mind will wander away from the breathing. You'll lose track of your breathing because you get caught up in your thoughts. And when that happens, simply note, be aware that that's happened in a very gentle, easygoing way, and then begin again with your breathing. Doesn't matter how many times the mind wanders off. What really matters here is that when you've noticed the mind wanders off, you begin again with your breathing, resting with the breath, hanging in there with the breath. As you stay with your breathing, see if the breathing can help you relax, become calm. As you exhale, let go of your thoughts, let go of any holding in your body, any restlessness. to help you stay with the breath, with each in-breath and out-breath, you might find it helpful to have a little whisper in the mind, a teeny, subtle, quiet whisper that says in as you breathe in and out as you breathe out. And each of those whispers is a reminder for you to stay there with the breath. Let everything else fall away the best you can. No need to think about anything at all. But let yourself, let your body and mind be massaged by the rhythmic breathing. Coming back to your breathing, staying with the breath. There's no need to get troubled by anything that's going on. If you can just stay there and feel the breaths, feel how the body experiences breathing, breathing in and breathing out. Letting the mind become quiet as you breathe. We'll do this for just another 2 minutes. In these last 2 minutes of the sitting, try to be as connected to your breathing as possible. See if you can do it without having the mind slip off even one breath. Just breathing. The whole universe is reduced to just breathing. There's a variety of things that sometimes happen to people when they first start meditating. One of the variations is that people will discover how much the mind is out of control. And your mind has a mind of its own. And you're trying to keep it attentive, and you tell your mind to stay there with the breath, and your mind wants to do something else, anything else but that. And it can be discouraging to realize, you know, it's so hard to stay with the breath. However, in trying to stay with the breath, you become aware of how the mind is distractible, caught up in its whirlwind of thoughts and concerns. And that is considered to be very valuable, to see that. It's said in Buddhism that it's more valuable to have a mind which is out of control and to know that it's out of control than it is to have a mind that's out of control and not to know it. So part of the process of waking up is to wake up to, oh, this is the truth. This is what's going on for me. And that's the beginning of this process of waking up. That's the beginning of this process of learning how to pay attention. Many times in many situations in life, you need a reference point to be able to see clearly what's going on. So the analogy I like to use is that of a quiet mountain stream that is very shallow water, very clear water, and you go look in that beautiful clear water in the stream, and you might not notice that the water is flowing. It might seem like the water looks like it's standing still. But if you take a stick and you put it upright into the water, then you might notice, oh yes, in fact, the water is moving. You see a little wake on the edges coming off the stick. You needed the stick as a reference point to see the movement. Many times in our lives, we don't know how fast our minds are going, how consumed or preoccupied or lost or the concerns of our mind, unless we kind of really stop and notice it. We have a reference point for it. And it turns out that trying to stay with your breath, something as simple as that, can be like a reference point. Wow, I didn't know my mind was going so fast. I didn't know that what was going on. I didn't know I was so tired. I didn't know that I was so grumpy. I didn't know I was so whatever. And sometimes people at that juncture will get discouraged. I can't stay with the breath. But the point of insight meditation is not staying with the breath. The point of insight meditation ultimately is noticing what's happening, being attentive to what's happening in the present moment. And being attentive to the mind is out of control is being attentive. You've succeeded. So if you can stay with your breath, great. If you can't stay with your breath, but trying to stay with your breath reveals to you much more clearly what's going on for you, otherwise you wouldn't see, great. So you can't do it wrong. Isn't that great? Another thing that happens when people start to sit sometimes is people get sleepy when they start to meditate. And it's been said that many Americans are sleep deprived. They need sleep more than they need meditation. And so that could be the case. Finally, you sit down, close your eyes. The only other time in life when you close your eyes for this length of time is to go to sleep. And if you're sleepy to begin with, you know, the mind starts going into its routine of falling asleep. Sometimes in meditation, the meditation has a calming effect. And if that calming effect becomes quite strong, it can lull a person into kind of a stupor or into kind of a dull state or sleepy state, falling asleep. Some people prefer not to meditate in the evening because they're more prone to fall asleep or be sleeping during meditation. Some people, will then meditate in the morning mostly. It's classic time to meditate is kind of first thing or early in the morning after waking up. Usually the mind is, most people is kind of fresher then. And maybe more important, your phone is not less likely to ring early in the morning. And people are going to leave you alone. Not so much is happening. So it's kind of a quiet time. Some people cherish that quiet early time before anybody else is awake. So there are many things that might happen in your experience in meditating. And all of it is part of the training, is part of, there's nothing which is inappropriate when you meditate, nothing that shouldn't be happening. It's just something else to learn to work with and to train with. And you become stronger as a meditator as you train with everything that might arise in your experience. And then part of the art of this practice is learning how to work or how to bring attention to whatever might arise so you can stay free or stay attentive in a clear way in the midst of it. So does anyone have any questions about that little meditation or want to say a little bit about your experience? Maybe it was unusual or something you want to report. Yes?
I have a question. When you talk about the mind always being concerned with all these things and wanting to go up, is that normal or is that something that we develop throughout a lifetime?
Oh, to some degree I believe it's normal. It just kind of comes with a human being. Being a human being, the mind thinks. The mind is supposed to think. That's what it's supposed to do. But the strength of that thinking and strength with which we preoccupied by those thoughts are something that sometimes gets developed in people as how they live their lives. And so, for example, if you have a very harried, hectic job that keeps you on three phones at the same time and doing two emails on two different computers at the same time and doing a lot of different things and never slowing down and doing, and then the mind is probably going to kind of get wound up. And so the mind's going to be so much more, because it's wound up, so much more going to get tripped over into being preoccupied again and again and again. But if you had a wonderful vacation and a wonderful nap and you're so, everything's going perfect in your life and you just had a great hike and you just kind of lay down and meditate, you know, sit down and meditate, and you know, there's no concerns at all, your mind is not grabbing and racing and trying to figure out and trying to accomplish or trying to protect or do all the things that the mind can get wound up to do. So to some degree, you know, and if a person spends a lifetime being caught up in a frenzy or a lot of particular concerns, then that there's kind of like a muscle that's gotten stronger and stronger. This muscle getting preoccupied. And so it takes a while then to break that habit. When people start to meditate, it can seem like it's going to take forever to break the habit. But it's actually very fast that we can change relative to how many mind moments we've spent distracted over a lifetime. You know, the ratio of how quickly it takes to kind of make correction for that is very, you know, much in your favor. Though it still might take, you know, months.
Well, you know what? There is a lot of people, and in my family, there are people who suffer from obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right.
And so this is supposed to be a chemical imbalance.
Right.
Now, this meditation technique, even though it's a chemical imbalance, and that is supposed to be out of their control, I tend to not think so. This is something that other than meditation would be something that can help that kind of thing.
It's possible. It's possible. I know people who've been benefited from meditation because of some chemical imbalance in their mind. But I wouldn't, if there's a chemical imbalance or a physiological imbalance someplace, some people will think, well, meditation is the only cure. And sometimes we'll have kind of like, oh, it has to be that way. Or they feel I can't take any medication or anything like that. It's not pure or something. And I'm a spiritual person, supposed to do it with my own, with my mind. And that sometimes is really unrealistic with certain kind of depressions or certain kind of like psychological conditions. And I sometimes strongly encourage people in some conditions to take medication to kind of bring a certain kind of balance to the mind. And then they can do the practice. And then as they do the practice, they might some people find that their psychological conditioning or the physiological conditioning gets improved through meditation. It's pretty common. But I wouldn't offer it as a panacea or as a, you know, solution to all things. Yes?
I actually have two questions. Well, how long do you do it? How much time is that?
I think about 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. And so, is there any sort of formula for how many minutes you should, you know, or it would be beneficial to meditate daily?
Mm-hmm.
Because the second question
Yeah.
So I was wondering if some physical something comes up, is that a good stopping point? Or do you, or do you just readjust and keep going?
Time is relative to all kinds of things. I know the Einstein quote about the relativity of time, and beautiful women. You don't know about beautiful women and time and Einstein, the second relativity theory. He said something like, time is relative. If I go and sit down on top of a hot stove, time can, and stay there, time, feels like a really long time. But if I sit in a conversation with some beautiful woman, it seems like time goes really fast. Something like that. I probably don't have it right, but... Yeah.
I had a lot more that I had to, it was a lot of time, or it seemed like a lot of time.
Right. We're impatient,
after that, because I was uncomfortable.
So you're welcome to change your posture if you get that uncomfortable. And we'll talk next week about how to work with pain that might arise in meditation. But it's fairly common for people to have their legs fall asleep if they're not used to sitting on the floor. And it takes sometimes a few weeks or something for the seemingly circulation to find other routes or to kind of compensate for it, and then they stop falling asleep. A few people will say that their legs never stop falling asleep when they meditate, and then they make a choice whether either to do it anyway or to sit in a chair. If the numbness, the sensation, doesn't end within a couple of minutes of breaking your posture and massaging your foot, if it takes like 5 or 10 minutes for you to get your sensation back, then you're not cutting your circulation, but rather you're pinching a nerve. And you never want to do that again. There's no way, don't even get close to it. I mean, make sure your posture is different. So how long to sit at home? So the benefits of doing this course and learning instructions are best if you actually practice every day at home during these 5 weeks, every day. And what I recommend that you do is sit either, for this first week, sit either 15 or 20 minutes a day. And then for the next few weeks after this, add 5 minutes a week until you get to 30 minutes or 35 minutes. And then you can kind of evaluate after that whether you want to stay there or do less, or find out what works for you in your life. In the long term, you want to find a length of time that works for you in your life that you live. If you set up some ideal that you want to sit for an hour every day and you never get to it because you never have an hour, that doesn't help. But if you say, well, I can sit for 15 minutes or 20 minutes every day, and you can really do it, then that's much better than a higher ideal that you never do. And so, and as you do it, some people find a lot of benefits and a lot of delight in doing an ongoing basis, and they might naturally want to extend it to longer. And I know a lot of people sit, I usually sit for 40 minutes myself in the morning, but some people will sit longer and some people shorter, and it really depends on what goes on in your life. And then, so that's, I think that's, does that answer your questions? Well, it's up to you how you do it, but I can offer you this guideline or this suggestion that it tends to be best to choose one time and one place to do your meditation. And if you have it, you meditate at home, to find a place, a corner maybe of your bedroom, that you're designated meditation spot. So that place doesn't have any other associations. Like this is that's where this happens. Just that, nothing else. And at the same time every day, so your mind gets into kind of expectation and rhythm. It comes easier that way. If you just, you have to think about when or negotiate, or the lawyers of the mind come up and say, well, maybe not later or whatever. But this is how you do it. And also, there's something very powerful for the mind, very helpful for the mind in having commitments. Commitments can be very useful. And to have a commitment to sit every day, no matter what, for the same length of time every day, 20 minutes, wherever you decide, can be a very powerful thing to do. And one of the reasons it's so useful, it tends to take the meditation out of the realm of our preferences. And we tend to be seduced by our preferences all the time. And so if we're meditating according to our preferences, then some people either meditate only when they're feeling bad, so they can feel better, or other people only meditate when they feel good. But if you meditate just because you're committed, no matter what, whether you feel good or bad or whatever, then what happens is that then the fullness, all aspects of your life, will get integrated into that awareness practice, which is a very useful thing to do. And you're establishing something, one little thing in your life that is not whether you're for or against it. And you get to find out what happens then if you're doing something that's outside of your preferences. And you're not negotiating and judging, or this is, you know, it's not going so well today, so I think I'll stop. No, you're going to learn how to pay attention, be present for something which is not pleasant. Or, you know, some people, if it's going really well, like, imagine the bliss is phenomenal. But your timer goes off after 20 minutes. It's time to get up. Your commitment is at 20 minutes, so you get up. And you have to let go of that attachment to, oh, this is what it's all about. So there's that. You can practice that way if you're interested with that kind of commitment. And that's for you to decide. That's the way I practiced for many years, and I found it very, very helpful just to have it very simple. It became very easy. It became like brushing my teeth. This is what I did. There was no questioning. It just became automatic. You see, in Buddhist, the goal of Buddhism is, in a sense, simplistically said, is to be free in all circumstances. And if you're only free in situations that are pleasant, then you're not free. And so if you want to cultivate your capacity to be free, you have to learn how to do it in situations which are unpleasant. And if every time you meditate and you feel some discomfort when you meditate, you end your meditation, then you're shortchanging your possibility of finding real freedom. So just because you're uncomfortable doesn't mean you necessarily stop. But you might wisely decide that you should maybe change your posture. Yes?
How about using quiet music as a way to get started?
Uh-huh. There's a lot of things a person could use, like quiet music or guided meditations, that can help a person get into it and get calm and relaxed and all that. And you can, you know, it's fine to do it. My recommendation for people is not to use it, because it's kind of a crutch. And what we want to do with mindfulness is to not use anything, but what we want to do is to notice what's happening in our mind as it's being lived, and to face up to it as it is. And if the mind is kind of racing or busy or stressed or something, then we try to just really see and work with that directly, rather than having this external thing that kind of massages it and helps it get in a good mood. In the long term, in the short term, it might be nice to do some music, but in the long term, you really want to it's very important not to have anything external that's a crutch for developing the practice. Yes?
If you can meditate while sitting on an easy chair,
No, a person can meditate in any posture at all. There's walking meditation, there's standing meditation, there's lying down meditation. So there's nothing inherently wrong with meditating in an easy chair, reclining, taking it easy, you know. There's a couple of things that you might pay attention to. One is that you're probably much more likely to fall asleep. And even if you don't fall asleep, you probably find yourself not so attentive. That's conducive to becoming calm. But calm is only half of what we're trying to do. The other half is we're trying to develop an alertness. And if you're too calm and you don't have enough alertness, the meditation doesn't go. And so if you're too alert in a sense and not calm enough, it doesn't go either. You want to have a nice balance of the two. And if you're in the easy chair, you might overdo the calmness side. And also, there's something very wonderful about having a relatively aligned posture for meditation, because then it allows the body to relax most fully. If I'm sitting like this, upright like this, it allows my shoulders to let go and relax probably to their full capacity. But if I'm meditating like this, my shoulders can't go very far because they're kind of being limited by the slouch. If you're sitting in an easy chair, resting back, you might feel the surface of your body kind of relaxed, But the deep structures of your body can't actually relax as deeply as if you're aligned and upright. Also, see, the principle of meditation is that you should always think in meditation that things that occur in pairs, in balance. Two factors get balanced with each other. So some people associate meditation so much with calmness and relaxation, but that's only one side. The other side is alertness and energy. And so if you're sitting in an easy chair, it tends to overemphasize the letting go, the relaxing side, and the muscles don't have a chance to develop some strength, some real core inner presence, here I am kind of thing. So I have my preferences that people don't use an easy chair to sit in, but it is possible. You know the story about the two monks who wanted to smoke in the monastery? No? So the first one said, well, I'm going to ask the abbot. And he goes into the abbot's office and says, is it okay if we smoke while we pray? And the abbot said, no, when you pray, you just pray, you know, nothing else, you know. Just. And so he left the office kind of dejected. And the second monk said, oh, let me go ask him. So the second monk went in and said, it came out a few minutes later and said, oh, he said it was fine to smoke. What did you ask him? I said, is it okay to pray while I smoke? And the abbot said, yes, you should always be praying. So, of course, it's fine to sit in the easy chair and meditate. Yes? Yes.
How do you prevent that?
By paying attention. One of the beautiful things about mindfulness, because mindfulness is a meditation practice that you're cultivating your ability to pay attention to what's happening in the present. And if you pay careful attention, you'll notice that you're escaping. You'll notice the consequences and the effect of that. There are other meditation practices besides this one. And some of them don't cultivate a lot of awareness in the same way. You're not paying careful attention to what's happening in the present moment. If you use a mantra or visualization, you can get very deeply calm. You can get into wonderful states. And some people will spend years in those states escaping. And they don't know how much they're escaping because they're not really paying careful attention to what's going on. The wonderful thing about the mindfulness practice is that there are problems that can arise as you do it. But they're self-correcting. Sooner or later, you'll notice what those problems are. So don't worry about it. Does that make sense? But if a person's really serious about meditation, is doing a lot of it, then it's really good to have someone you check in with periodically. It could be a good friend or some another person who meditates, or perhaps a teacher. And sometimes you need a teacher or a friend, that kind of, or a wife or a husband or some or spouse, to kind of, poke you in the ribs and say, hey, you know, I think what you're doing is not so useful. You're avoiding the fact that something, X, Y, and Z. Yes?
While I was focusing on my breaths, and I started to notice my heart beat, and there was a walk here of that meditation, I started to get anxious and, oh, so I can't count my heartbeat. Then I sort of get back, oh, now I have to focus my breath rather than my heartbeat, and even that's part of my body too. And so is there good or bad or anything I should be aware of? Or?
About the heartbeat?
Yeah.
You know, so there are times in meditation where the heartbeat stands out quite strongly and quite aware of it. You can be aware of it in a kind of easygoing way. I wouldn't take it as the primary object of meditation. I would stay with the breath. Just let the heartbeat be there in the kind of the background. Last one, and then I have some more things to say.
I'm just noticing my own experience. Obviously, this is a formalized practice, but I'm not formally meditating now, and I kind of feel the same. I'm just noticing myself And I presume that that's something that the boundaries blur more and more as you get more into it, more involved.
They do for some people, and actually we tend to want that to happen. The boundaries is pretty arbitrary between the mind that's meditating and the mind that's not. And as we learn to pay more careful attention, develop some kind of calm integrity as we sit and meditate, there tends to be a strong tendency for people to want to live that in the rest of their life also. And so the way to do that is to start, do the same practice in daily life. Pay attention to what's happening. Stay in the present as things are going on. And sometimes when I've taught this intro class, especially after the first week, it's not. If you listen to me carefully, you find that I blur the boundaries, and it's not always so clear that I'm talking about meditation or whether I'm talking about mindfulness in daily life. Because I myself don't see a strong separation between them. So, if you're sitting here meditating, or any place. And your mind is thinking about work, or about what's going to happen tomorrow, or about a conversation you had earlier, then in a sense, your mind and your body are in two different places. And what we're trying to do in meditation is have the mind and the body be in the same place at the same time. And the only option for that to happen, because the body's not going to go anywhere, is, you know, away from your mind, is your mind has to come into your body. You want your attention, your mind, to be focused on what's happening here in the present moment, what's happening now. It's really marvelous, the present moment. Almost all the most wonderful things that people tend to enjoy the most in life occur as we're present for them, we're in the present moment. Joy, love, peace, creativity, a lot of things happen when we're really in the present moment. If we're lost in the future and the past, some of the more beautiful things often aren't so present or available for us. But to train the mind and the body to be together in the same place at the same time creates a kind of harmony where the mind and the body are not fragmented or working against each other. Many people's minds tend to be quite fragmented from each other, which causes a lot of stress and problems in itself. And it's a kind of a re-education of the mind to teach the mind that it doesn't have to be thinking about the future, thinking about the past, thinking about projects, thinking about ideas. And then maybe it's not to the mind's ultimate benefit to always be involved in that, but to have the option sometimes to drop all the external future and past and fantasies and ideas and have the capacity to really deeply for the mind to rest on itself, or the heart to rest on itself, to be here with ourselves, to have the body and mind together in the same place at the same time, to be in the present moment. It's one of the really most delightful things that's available for human beings to do that. And so it's often a re-education of the mind. And sometimes people have to wrestle a little bit with themselves to really learn that that's really worthwhile to do. The lawyers of the mind will pop up and explain why it's so important to think about almost anything else. So don't listen to those lawyers. They're very convincing. And just very calmly, in a relaxed way, come back to the breath, be with the breath. And for this next week, just make the breath the be-all and end-all of what you do for the meditation practice. Sit for 15, 20 minutes each day and just surrender to your breath. Just let the breath be it. And mind, of course, will wander off. We know that. And then come back. If the mind wanders off a lot, then know that you're learning to pay attention to the forces of your mind. How wonderful those are. There is out there by the door in this chair, I think, a handout that looks like this. I hope there's enough for all of you. I have handouts for the first 4 weeks with a written description of the practice that I've just taught, and today the mindfulness of breathing. And also each week there's homework for you to do besides just your 15, 20 minutes of meditation. And I think if you do the homework, again, I think you'll learn, get a lot more from the class. And what I'm going to talk about next week will be so much, you know, you'll be able to use it, take it in much more in a deeper way, if you've kind of done these exercises at home. If for some reason there's not enough of these flyers, these handouts out there, then in our newsletter, which is out on the table, there is the email address for our info line, info@probably midpeninsight.org. And you could email that info line, ask for a copy of this week number one handout, and they'll do it for you. And it's not on the table now, but maybe we can do it as soon as we break. I have this book of mine that was published for free distribution that talks about this practice and gives more instructions for this kind of practice. It's called The Issue at Hand. And we'll put out a stack of them out there on the table. And if you want an interest in taking that book, you're welcome to take it. And the last thing to say is that the way that everything that happens here at the center is offered in the spirit of what we call dana, which basically means the spirit of being freely given. And it's one of the commitments we have is not to charge for anything that happens here at our center. And we haven't so far. You know, so people come to, we have a lot of whole full program much of the week of sittings and retreats and classes and all kinds of things. And people just wander in off the street and no one's there at the door asking with a ticket or, you know, there's no financial obstacles. And but the way that the center is supported is that those people who would like to can make a donation in the box that's by the door. It's called a dana box or donation box. And there are two slots there. One is what's called the operations slot. And that's actually for running the operations, running, you know, paying electricity or publishing a newsletter, you know, the kind of expenses we have for owning this building and having it here. And the other is called a teacher slot. And that's for the teacher, which in this case would be me. And the way I work here is this is my kind of livelihood. This is what I do. This is my you know, I'm a full-time teacher here for IMC, for the center. And I don't get paid by IMC. It's like I'm not on a salary. But I continue in the same spirit that the tradition has gone for 2,500 years, which is freely given. And I'm really delighted to do that. And if you are interested in availing yourself of that donation box, that would be great. It's up to you. So, yes? Oh, if you miss a class and you would like to listen to the class that you missed, there's a couple of things you can do. One is you can arrange with Allison, and she can give you a copy of either this class that's been done or some previous class. Or we have a website called audiodharma.org. And I think it's in our newsletter. And all the talks that are given here at our center, most of them, are up there on audio files. So most computers, you can just tap into the World Wide Web and just listen to these things on the web. And I think previous classes of this are up there. Not this class, I don't think, will be up there, but previous ones are.
So
just one set. So if you know you're going to miss week two, you can go there and get to week two. So if you have any further questions, you're welcome to stay behind and ask me. Otherwise, have a wonderful week.